featuring a mix of big-name acts and some local faves as well. On March 8th, Montreal punks The Anti-Queens hit the stage in celebration of International Women's Day. Then, on March 14th, don't miss Kingston's Good Times supergroup, Rocket Surgery. On March 16th, the Great Big C's Sean McCann hits the Spire, and the Mahones rage the stage on St. Patrick's Day. On March 20th, the Cancer Bats return to town, and on March 22nd, Canadian pop sensation and Queens alum Devin Cole puts on a show. And on March 29th, don't miss the sweet sounds of Dom Lewis. Unless noted, all KPP shows co-presented by CFRC 101.9 FM take place at the Broom Factory. For full info and tickets, visit kppconcerts.com.
Kim Purcell is an award-winning real estate sales representative working under the Sutton Group Masters Realty Brokerage. Kim was born and raised in Kingston and is into her ninth year of real estate. She has intimate knowledge of the area, which has positively influenced her career as a realtor and led to numerous five-star reviews from clients. If you're looking for a real estate agent in the Kingston area who is trustworthy and will work for your best interests, you're in good hands with Kim. Visit kimpurcell.ca to learn more about Kim's realty services and listings today.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
The importance of the election on Tuesday is gigantic. It could decide the future of the House of Representatives. It could decide then the future of America and the future of the world.
Why is Elon Musk spending some $20 million on Wisconsin Supreme Court election Tuesday in what's become the most expensive judicial race in U.S. history, giving away $1 million checks to two voters who signed one of his petitions? We'll speak with longtime Wisconsinite John Nichols of The Nation. Then, after President Trump fires most of the board and leadership of the John F. Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts, we'll talk to ousted artistic director Mark Bamuti Joseph.
I'm taking down everything black in my office, just as the new leadership of the Kennedy Center is doing its best to disavow much of the literal color that has made this place special.
Finally, we remember Free Press co-founder Robert McChesney, a tireless defender of media and democracy.
What we've seen is that the internet was promised to be this great engine of economic competition. It was going to spur economic growth, create all these new businesses, huge amounts of jobs. Remember the term new economy from the late 90s? And instead, what we've seen is the internet is arguably the biggest generator of monopoly in the history.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The death toll in Burma, also known as Myanmar, from Friday's 7.7 magnitude earthquake has topped 2,000. It's expected to rise significantly as rescuers try to reach people buried under the rubble. At least 19 people also died in Thailand. The World Health Organization is warning healthcare facilities in Burma are overwhelmed as aid and humanitarian groups express alarm over the devastation.
People are just, you know, desperate, devastated. When I see the damage at the bridges and the roads, it was so huge. I have never seen anything like that in my life before. We were so astonished when we see the situation in Mandalay. Everything is like gone and people are still trapped and the casualties and everything is still counting.
The New York Times reports President Trump's dismantling of USAID has hampered the U.S. response to the earthquake in Burma, while China, Russia and India quickly sent emergency teams. A three-person team from the U.S. is not expected to arrive until Wednesday. On Friday, some workers at USAID's Bureau for Humanitarian Assistance received layoff emails while they were preparing to respond to the earthquake. Burma's one of Asia's poorest nations, has been ruled by a military junta since a coup in 2021. Over the weekend, rebel groups accused the junta of carrying out airstrikes following the earthquake. Israeli forces are continuing to attack Gaza as Palestinians observe the second day of Eid al-Fitr to mark the end of Ramadan. On Sunday, Israeli attacks killed at least 64 Palestinians. Dozens of more Palestinians have been killed today, including many children. This comes as the United Nations is warning Gaza may run out of flour for bread within a week as Israel continues its total blockade of aid. Meanwhile, the Palestine Red Crescent Society has recovered the bodies of 15 emergency workers, including 8 medics with the Red Crescent, who were killed when Israeli forces opened fire on their vehicles near Rafah last week. It was the single deadliest attack on Red Cross or Red Crescent workers in the world since 2017. Jonathan Woodhull, a top UN official in Gaza, spoke at the site of the mass grave.
Health workers should never be a target, and yet we're here today digging up a mass grave of first responders and paramedics. 7 days ago, civil defense and PRCS ambulances arrived at the scene. One by one, they were hit, they were struck, their bodies were gathered and buried in this mass grave. We're digging them out in their uniforms, with their gloves on. They were here to save lives. Instead, they ended up in a mass grave. Their vehicles, their ambulances, UN vehicles, civil defense vehicles are crushed and dumped, covered in sand next to us. It's an absolute horror. What has happened here?
In news from the occupied West Bank, Israeli settlers and soldiers have repeatedly attacked Palestinians living in the village of Jinba and Masafer Yatta. On Friday, a settler mob attacked the village and injured 6 Palestinians, including a 64-year-old man who suffered a skull fracture. Hours later, Israeli forces raided the village and handcuffed and blindfolded all the Palestinian men in the village. At least 22 Palestinians were detained. The Associated Press ran an article about what happened with the headline, Israeli settlers seen on camera assaulting a Palestinian village. Police arrest only Palestinians, the headline read. The attacks come a week after settlers brutally beat the Palestinian filmmaker Hamdan Bilal, who was then detained by Israel's military. The attack on Bilal came just weeks after he won an Academy Award for co-directing the documentary No Other Land about violent Israeli settlers trying to seize his community in Masafer Yatta. On Friday, the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences issued a statement apologizing for not initially supporting Bilal after he was beaten and detained. In Lebanon, an Israeli airstrike blew up a residential building in Beirut's southern suburbs on Friday. It was the first Israeli attack on Beirut since a truce was reached in November. Residents of the neighborhood decried the Israeli strikes.
This destruction, we got used to it. There's nothing new. This is their approach. Their approach is vandalism, destruction. Their approach is killing. They don't need a reason to hit us. They invented a reason to hit us now. This is normal, and all the world knows it. The old and young know it. Praise to be God.
Israel also attacked the town of Kafr Tibnit in southern Lebanon, killing at least 3 people and wounding 18, including women and children. The U.S. is continuing its bombing campaign targeting the Houthis in Yemen. Overnight, U.S. airstrikes hit areas of the capital, Sana'a. The U.S. also attacked Yemen early Saturday. Houthi officials say the U.S. strikes have killed at least 59 people since March 15th, after Houthi fighters said they would resume Red Sea cargo attacks over Israel's renewed all-out war on Gaza. Residents in Yemen criticize the ongoing U.S. attacks.
The American-Israeli aggression has carried out several airstrikes on the outskirts of the city of Sada, resulting in the martyrdom and injury of some citizens. We want to tell the American enemy that this bombing will not deter us from supporting Gaza.
President Trump has told NBC News he won't rule out using military force to annex Greenland, to take it from Denmark. Trump's comment came a day after Vice President J.D. Vance visited Greenland as part of his delegation with his wife, Usha Vance, and National Security Advisor Mike Waltz. On a scaled-back trip, they only visited a remote U.S. space base north of the Arctic Circle, the base about 1,000 miles north of Greenland's capital, Nuuk. During the speech to U.S. troops, Vance repeatedly accused Denmark of neglecting Greenland.
The president said we have to have Greenland, and I think that we do have to be more serious about the security of Greenland. We can't just ignore this place. We can't just ignore the president's desires.
One Danish TV channel reported U.S. officials went door-to-door in Greenland looking for locals who would be willing to meet with Second Lady Usha Vance, but the U.S. officials couldn't find anyone interested. She was originally scheduled to go to Greenland's National Dog Sledding Championship, but under pressure, the U.S. dramatically scaled back the scope of the trip, which Greenland's prime minister criticized as, quote, highly aggressive. In the capital, Nuuk, residents criticized the U.S. vice president for coming to Greenland.
I don't want the U.S. to invade us. They can do their own business, military business in Thule, but they are not welcome here in Nuuk.
In immigration news, the Trump administration's asked the U.S. Supreme Court to overturn a lower judge's ruling that has blocked Trump from removing more immigrants from the United States after he invoked the Alien Enemies Act of 1798. The Justice Department filed an emergency appeal Friday, claiming U.S. District Judge James Boasberg had unconstitutionally intruded on the president's national security powers by ordering the Trump administration to stop sending Venezuelan immigrants accused without evidence of being gang members to a Supermax prison complex in El Salvador. Meanwhile, a number of immigration-related protests took place nationwide this weekend. In Florida, hundreds protested outside the Chrome Detention Center, condemning what they described as inhumane conditions at the prison. Two men have died at Chrome over the past 2 months. Meanwhile, thousands of protesters marched in Dallas, Texas, against Trump's immigration policies. Hector Flores is president of the League of United Latin American Citizens, known as LULAC.
We Latinos are the backbone of this great state. We build the buildings. We paint the murals. We cook the meals from every culture in every corner of this country. We are the architects, the artisans, the chefs, the caregivers, the teachers, the scientists. Look around you. Look at these wonderful multitude that are here. We all do the different work that has to be done in this country that makes America great.
The news site Zateo is reporting the Trump administration's begun secretly revoking immigration statuses of international university students without the knowledge of the students or their universities. Most of the students have reportedly been from the Middle East and Muslim-majority countries. The move by ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, makes it possible for federal agents to then seize the students without warning. In related news, the Times of India reports the State Department's emailed hundreds of international students asking them to self-deport for allegedly participating in campus activism. This comes as legal battles continue over a number of students who've already been detained. On Saturday, protesters gathered outside a federal building in Minneapolis after ICE detained a graduate student at U. That's the University of Minnesota. On Friday, protesters also rallied outside a New Jersey courthouse where a hearing was held in the case of Mahmoud Khalil, the Columbia graduate student protest leader who was detained 3 weeks ago and sent to Louisiana. Amy Torres is the head of the New Jersey Alliance for Immigrant Justice.
Yes, this is about Palestine, and also this is not about Palestine. This is about this administration taking the issue that they believe is the least sympathetic and making an example out of the people that they arrest, so that they can dehumanize the issue, they can dehumanize the actors, they can dehumanize the people standing up as a means of going after every single one of us.
In related news, the interim president of Columbia University, Katrina Armstrong, resigned Friday, just a week after the school capitulated to a number of demands by the Trump administration, which had threatened to pull $400 million in federal funding from the school. Columbia's board of trustees then elevated its own board co-chair, Claire Shipman, in a highly unusual move to become the school's new interim president. On Saturday, a group of Columbia alumni ripped up their diplomas to protest the detention of Mahmoud Khalil and what they see as the school's complicity with the Trump administration. Another major law firm has agreed to cut a deal with President Trump. The firm Skadden Arps has agreed to provide more than $100 million in pro bono work for initiatives backed by the Trump administration in an effort to avoid being sanctioned by the White House. Meanwhile, another firm, Perkins Coie, has opted to challenge Trump's sanctions, but the Financial Times reports other large firms are refusing to sign a brief supporting Perkins Coie amid concerns they'll face retaliation by President Trump. On Saturday, demonstrators gathered at over 200 Tesla dealerships and facilities nationwide in a protest over Tesla CEO Trump advisor Elon Musk's role in what they described as an illegal coup. Hundreds protested outside a Tesla dealership in Brooklyn, New York.
Well, I don't really care about Musk. What I care about is the rule of law and the people, you know, getting to see their government working the way it's supposed to. And it's not supposed to be run by an unelected billionaire who callously tears apart scientific research, you know, putting cancer survivors at risk, putting federal trials that are going to learn cures. Everybody gets sick. Who are these people who think we don't need science?
A day after the mass protests, Elon Musk traveled to Green Bay, Wisconsin, ahead of Tuesday's state Supreme Court election. Musk has spent around $20 million to support the Trump-backed judicial candidate Brad Schimmel over liberal Susan Crawford in what's become the most expensive judicial election in U.S. history. On Friday, Wisconsin's attorney general sued Musk for offering to give $1 million checks to two voters who signed one of his petitions. On Sunday, Musk went ahead with his giveaway.
Let me first hand out two $1 million checks in appreciation.
We'll have more on Elon Musk and the Wisconsin judicial race and beyond after headlines. President Trump has admitted to NBC that he's considering ways he could serve a third term as president, despite a constitutional ban preventing him from doing so. Trump said, quote, there are methods which you could do it, unquote. He went on to say, I'm not joking. Unquote. The 22nd Amendment of the U.S. Constitution states, quote, no person shall be elected to the office of the president more than twice. In health news, the top vaccine regulator at the Food and Drug Administration, Dr. Peter Marks, has resigned after being forced out by Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. In his resignation letter, Marks wrote, quote, it's become clear truth and transparency are not desired by the secretary, but rather he wishes subservient confirmation of his misinformation and lies, unquote. Meanwhile, HHS has hired David Geyer, a longtime vaccine skeptic, to head a federal study of immunizations and their relationship with autism. In addition, ProPublica's reporting the Centers for Disease Control ordered staff last week not to release a report on measles that stressed the need for vaccinations. This all comes amidst a measles outbreak that has infected over 520 people, including over 400 in Texas, almost entirely among unvaccinated individuals. In news from Sudan, the Sudanese military has taken control of a major market in Omdurman, the twin city of the capital, Khartoum. This brings the military closer to regaining full control of the entire capital area. On Sunday, the military's rivals, the Rapid Support Forces, confirmed it had pulled troops out of Khartoum, but the RSF threatened to return. And a French court today has barred far-right anti-immigrant leader Marine Le Pen from running for office for 5 years, blocking her from the 2027 presidential race. The ruling, which could upend French politics, came after a court found her guilty of embezzling European Union funds to help finance her far-right National Rally Party. Le Pen was also sentenced to 4 years in prison. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We begin today's show in Wisconsin, where billionaire advisor to Donald Trump, Elon Musk, spoke in Green Bay ahead of Tuesday's state Supreme Court election. Musk has spent around $20 million to support Trump-backed candidate Brad Schimmel over liberal Susan Crawford in what's become the most expensive judicial election in U.S. history. On Friday, Wisconsin's attorney general sued Musk for offering to give $1 million checks to two voters who signed one of his petitions. On Sunday, Musk went ahead with his giveaway.
Let me first hand out two $1 million checks in appreciation.
Musk is heavily involved in Wisconsin's judicial election, claiming liberals could use the 4-3 they have on the state Supreme Court to change voting districts and impact election results in the swing state.
The importance of the election on Tuesday is gigantic. It could decide the future of the House of Representatives. It could decide then the future of America and the future of the world. So it's absolutely critical that you really, you need to just drag friends and family to vote on Tuesday for Justice Schimmel and for voter ID.
As Elon Musk backs conservative Republican Brad Schimmel, the Democratic Party of Wisconsin's countered with political ads endorsing Judge Susan Crawford.
Cutting rape crisis centers, attacking Social Security. Elon Musk is out of control. And now the power-hungry billionaire is unloading millions to buy the Wisconsin Supreme Court. He knows MAGA politician Brad Schimmel is for sale.
For more, we're joined by longtime Wisconsinite John Nichols of The Nation magazine. His recent piece headlined, "The Wisconsin Supreme Court Race Has Become All About Elon Musk." John, welcome back to Democracy Now! As Elon Musk says himself, I mean, this judicial race, which usually doesn't get anything like this attention, not to mention the tens of millions of dollars that has been put into the race, could affect not only the balance of the House of Representatives. Well, what Elon Musk said is it could affect Western civilization. Talk about the significance of what's going on.
Well, I've often been teased for saying Wisconsin is the center of the universe, but apparently Elon Musk has confirmed that. And what's going on in Wisconsin is a very intense race for state Supreme Court. Wisconsin has had quite a few of these in recent years. That's because our court is incredibly powerful. And we are a very divided state. Wisconsin is the ultimate battleground state in the U.S. Of the last seven presidential races, five of them have been decided by around 30,000 votes or less. And so often things come to the court. Cases on abortion rights, cases on labor rights, cases on voting rights. In fact, in 2000, the court decided by a narrow 4-3 margin to reject Donald Trump's challenges to Wisconsin's vote for president. And so for a variety of reasons, both parties have focused on this court, even though it's a nonpartisan court. And this year's race is incredibly significant because currently the court has a 4-3 progressive majority. That's for the first time in a very long time. That progressive majority is likely to protect abortion rights, to encourage labor rights, and to protect voting rights. This is something that Republicans in Wisconsin are quite upset about. They made it clear they were going to try and upend that 4-3 majority and shift it to a 4-3 conservative majority. The thing that is different this time is that the richest man in the world, Elon Musk, has since January been obsessed with this race. He messages about it on social media. In February, he started giving substantial money. He is now up to at least 20 million. I think when the final count comes, it will probably be substantially more than that. And as you've noted, last night, he flew into Green Bay for what was actually not that big a rally. You know, a decent number of people. But he gave away two checks for $1 million. He is also now making a new offer that to people who are going door to door, if you communicate that you've gone to the doors, you'll get $20 or something like that. And so he's just pouring money into the race in an effort to tip it to Brad Schimmel, who is a very, very right-wing Republican, long associated with former Governor Scott Walker. And if Schimmel gets on the court, I mean, there's very little doubt that he will rule in a very friendly way, not just to Republicans, but particularly to corporate interests. And I think that's what really interests Elon Musk.
His position on abortion, very quickly, John?
Brad Schimmel has been a longtime opponent of abortion rights. He comes from Waukesha County, which is a very historically very conservative county in Wisconsin. And his whole career, he's been a militant foe of abortion rights. That's a big deal because Wisconsin has a battle going on about an 1849 law that effectively bans abortion. And if Schimmel went on the court, it is within the realm of reason that that law could be reanimated.
I want to turn to the televised debate on Wisconsin's Supreme Court election between Schimmel and Crawford, both judges. In this clip, Schimmel's asked if he would ever rule against President Trump if a case ever came into his courtroom.
If President Trump violates the law, or President Trump brings a lawsuit that he's wrong on the law, of course I would. I don't have any personal loyalty to him that supersedes the oath I take as a judge. There's no question.
So he's been described as a MAGA judge, but what about his response, John?
Well, he's a politician. You know, the thing to understand about Brad Schimmel is he really is a career politician. He's been on the ballot multiple times, on the Republican ballot line for district attorney and for state attorney general during the Walker years. And he does say that, but he's also said that he thinks that we have to develop a quote-unquote support network for Donald Trump to make sure that his agenda is protected. And after he did that debate appearance, he appeared at an event, or there circulated a picture from an event with him standing in front of a 20-foot tall blow-up Donald Trump balloon. So I think he might have been fabricating just a little in his statement there.
If you can talk about the special elections, if you can talk about what's going on in Florida right now, Waltz and Gates' seats, and also what's happening in Louisiana and the significance of this moment for Donald Trump as he pulls Elise Stefanik's nomination to be the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations because he's concerned of her leaving her seat.
Right. This is a politically volatile moment for Donald Trump. It often happens in the first months of a new presidential term. You have special elections, local elections, state elections, which begin to give you a sense of whether people are impressed with what the president is doing or are upset and angry with it. And we're starting to see some real signs of resistance to Donald Trump at the ballot box. In Louisiana on Saturday, there were four constitutional amendments. These were described as mega amendments. They sought to put a cap on taxation. They sought to put a cap on spending and on budgets. They sought to pull back a stipend for teachers, all sorts of things like that. The governor of Louisiana, who's very powerful and a Republican who was elected not that long ago, campaigned for these four amendments. They all went down by overwhelming margins. They were all defeated. And that's very surprising coming out of Louisiana. In fact, some people are referring to it as a political earthquake. And what happened was you had a very significant turnout of black and working class voters mobilized by a coalition that was saying this is a real problem. So in Louisiana, a very conservative state, you saw a pushback against Trump and Musk. On Tuesday, you have the Wisconsin race, which has become, you know, center of political news in the U.S. and even around the world. But you also have two special elections in Florida for seats that were vacated when Donald Trump appointed, as you mentioned, Matt Gaetz and Waltz to positions in his administration. In both of those races, the Democratic candidates are running way better than expected, even though those are very Republican-leaning districts. I'm not saying the Florida races will flip, but it is within the realm of reason that one of them could. And if you have this scenario where Louisiana rejects these amendments, where a Florida seat flips, where Wisconsin rejects Elon Musk's money, you could have a real significant measure of the popular objection to what Trump and Musk are doing. Obviously, if the Wisconsin race goes the other way, if the Florida races go Republican, you won't get that message. But that's why everyone is looking at what's happening, you know, on Saturday in Louisiana and now on Tuesday in Florida and Wisconsin, because we may get the first real electoral measure of where America stands on Donald Trump and Elon Musk.
Bernie Sanders has endorsed Weil in the Waltz open seat race right now in Florida. Bernie Sanders, who's been going around the country in a fighting oligarchy tour and been getting unprecedented thousands of people coming out. The significance of this in Florida, in DeSantis's Florida.
It's very interesting because, as you say, while the Democratic candidate in that 6th district race in Florida, has gotten an endorsement from Senator Bernie Sanders. I talked to Senator Sanders about it yesterday, and Senator Sanders said that the Weil campaign really wanted this endorsement. And in fact, on social media, they very much embraced the endorsement of Bernie Sanders. Now, that might not have been a typical thing in a Republican-leaning district, except that one of the things that is fascinating about Bernie Sanders' tour of the United States, this fighting oligarchy tour in which he's been joined by Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Greg Kassar, and others, is that he is going generally to Republican-held districts. And that's one of the kind of lost realities of this. He is drawing thousands of people in Republican-leaning areas. The theory is, or the thinking is, that this may be a moment where the typical Democrat might not do so well. There's a lot of objections to where the Democratic Party is, even people who believe that the Democratic Party hasn't done enough to fight against Trump and Musk. But there is a high degree of buy-in, if you will, for Bernie Sanders' message that billionaires should not be controlling our government. And so we're going to, again, get another test of that down in Florida.
I want to thank you, John Nichols, for being with us and ask you to stay with us later in the broadcast. We're going to remember your colleague, the well-known media democracy activist and professor Robert McChesney. John Nichols is the nation's national affairs correspondent, and we'll link to your piece, The Wisconsin Supreme Court Race Has Become All About Musk. But first, when we come back, as President Trump fires most of the board and leadership of the John F. Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts, we'll speak with ousted artistic director, Vice President Mark Bamuthi Joseph. Stay with us.
Oh, say, can you see by the dawn's early light what so proudly we hailed at the twilight's last gleaming, whose broad stripes and bright stars through the perilous fight, o'er the ramparts we watched was so gallantly streaming.
That's Jon Batiste singing the Star Spangled Banner at the start of the Super Bowl earlier this year, as President Trump saluted attending the game, the first president to do so. The performance came just days after Trump fired Jon Batiste and others from serving on the board of the John F. Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. As we turn to the Trump administration's intensifying attacks on cultural institutions and diversity, equity and inclusion efforts, including the John F. Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts. In February, President Trump ousted the center's longtime chair, David Rubenstein, made himself chair of the board. Trump also fired longtime president Deborah Rutter. Last week, the Kennedy Center fired at least seven members of its social impact initiative, including its vice president, artistic director, the renowned artist Mark Bamuthi Joseph. The team aimed to expand the Art Center's reach to diverse audiences to commission new works by Black composers. The job terminations come weeks after President Trump took over the Kennedy Center and also appointed his allies, including his chief of staff, Susie Wiles, to the board, and her mother, and Second Lady Usha Vance, and two hosts on Fox News, Laura Ingraham and Maria Bartiromo. Mark Bamuthi Joseph recorded this video from his office just after he was fired.
Well, I am sitting in my office at the Kennedy Center one last time. It's funny, I'm taking things down like this red, black, and green American flag and this extraordinary piece of artwork that my man Greg made that honors Stevie Wonder, and this poster from BAM, and a commemorative album that was organized by Swiss Beats. Basically, I'm taking down everything black in my office, just as the new leadership of the Kennedy Center is doing its best to disavow much of the literal color that has made this place special. I'm grieving and angry and also ready to be rid of the moral injury that has come with being in this place. It's hard to say goodbye, but it isn't hard to say goodbye to an oppressive situation. So may liberation be my liturgy. I'm proud of what we made here. We will always have an impact.
Mark Vamuchi Joseph, speaking after he was fired as vice president and artistic director of social impact at the Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts, the last time he was in his office. And this is a portion from Mark Vamuchi Joseph's spoken word performance Friday, when he went back to Oakland for a timely production with the Oakland Symphony titled The Forgiveness Suite, accompanied by musician Daniel Bernard Romain.
Steps to grace. Face the hurts. Unthread the truth. Choose mercy. Engage your transgressor. Say, I leave this pain with you. Grace requires a loosening of other people's stuff for American socialized black girls who considered shame reflexively when self-love wasn't enough. Grace is never enough when the forgiveness isn't deserved. But here you are, facing the truth, reconciling the pain by extending grace.
You've been listening to Mark Vamuchi Joseph. He joins us right now from Virginia. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Vamuchi. Talk about what happened last week. Talk about what's happening to the Kennedy Center.
Peace, Amy. Good morning to you, and good morning to everyone listening and watching. I feel so privileged to be the child of immigrants, and having lived in the state of California for a long time, moving to D.C. infused me with a different sense of patriotism and connection to the American promise, to the plurality that makes this country truly great. There has been, as you've distilled, an infusion of a kind of binary political discourse into what's supposed to be a sanctuary for freedom of thought and freedom of creative expression. The Kennedy Center, it should be said, has not officially canceled any performances or explicitly, contractually removed themselves from relationship to any artists. But as you've been describing so diligently and so bravely over the course of your entire career, we create atmosphere through rhetoric. The stated agenda, as institutionalized in spaces like the National Endowment for the Arts, let's say, severely restricts and almost criminalizes demographic realities outside of white, straight, male Christianity. The specific attack on gay, trans, and drag performers has narrowed the cultural radius at the Kennedy Center significantly, so that artists feel like they can't, in good conscience, come to the Kennedy Center. So you're seeing artists like Issa Rae or the producers of Hamilton or the artist Rhiannon Giddens remove themselves from their relationship to the Kennedy Center. And that in turn trickles down to the brave staff who are arts professionals who care about cultural providence and have to do their very best to make it possible for artists to continue to be at their best. But against the backdrop of this oppressive regime and this politically narrow board of directors, that's extraordinarily difficult to do.
I mean, you have this unbelievable moment that we just played. John Batiste playing Star Spangled Banner. President Trump is saluting at the Super Bowl. And he had just fired him from the board of trustees of the Kennedy Center, along with many others. And then John F. Kennedy, you've got the portrait there in the John F. Kennedy Performing Arts Center. And when he came for his board meeting, President Trump is chair, what he put up, new portraits, himself, his wife, Usha Vance, and Vice President Vance.
Yeah. You know, what you're seeing all over government are folks who aren't necessarily experienced in the lines or departments or vectors of action that they're supposed to lead. And there is no formal experience in either nonprofits, arts management, or the art of curation that is now present at the top of the organizational chart, beginning with the board chair. So, you know, the desire to satisfy, you know, one's ego, or the desire to be vengeful apparently has superseded the desire to serve this nation in terms of making safe space for artists, particularly artists from historically marginalized communities or historically minoritized communities, to thrive. The work that we did in social impact, and I'm so proud of my team, my staff, and all of my colleagues who supported us, you know, that work was meant to focus on the historically marginalized, but also it connected to this idea of the constitutionality of inspiration. Our belief is that you cannot be you cannot have access to the franchise, to the American franchise, if you don't have access to the impulse of creativity. That just like you have access to the ballot box or under equal protection under the law, under the 14th Amendment, you also have access and protection to inspiration. How can you be an American if you cannot hope? And who authors hope more than artists? So this diminishment of creativity, of ideas, the diminishment of folks' access to high-level inspired works of art is among the more un-American things I think that a leader would do.
During your time there, Mark Bamuthi Joseph, you helped launch the Culture Caucus, which offered two-year residencies with groups that work with queer and trans youth, formerly incarcerated people, the disabled community. You also established a national partnership called Conflux, which worked with the National Arab Orchestra, the First Nations community, and World Pride, your audience, mainly wealthy and white. And you can you talk about the direction that Trump is now taking the Performing Arts Center in? We heard from what Steve Bannon, one of his allies, that he had spoken to Rick Grenell, the new head of the Kennedy Center, that they're going to be bringing one of the first performances, the January 6th choir, to perform there, to usher in a new era of culture in the new Kennedy Center.
Yeah, I won't speak to the president's curatorial tastes. They speak for themselves. I think maybe what I would point to is the list of maybe more than 200 musicians who didn't want their music played at his rallies. That speaks to a broader environment, I think, and disconnect between the arts community and the political direction of the president of the United States. All the work that you cited, that's the work that we stand on and that we're proud of. You know, your listeners and your viewers know, going out to have a date night or a family night is increasingly expensive. Parking and food and, you know, not to mention the cost of the tickets themselves, childcare. A lot of the work that we did was we lowered the barrier to entry from a financial standpoint, but also from a social standpoint. You know, my folks always want to know who all gonna be there, right? Well, what we did in social impact was we helped usher in a culture of invitation. The Kennedy Center, historically, at its best, produces more than 2,000 events a year. So maybe less than focus on what happens curatorially, I think we all have to ask ourselves how many artists are willing to come into a space with such a narrow field of cultural vision. What is the scale of the Kennedy Center going to be like 6 months from now or a year from now? What happens to inside the building is only as powerful as the people and the artists within it. So, you know, God bless all the curators at the Kennedy Center. But maybe more importantly, God bless the artists who now have perhaps one less venue to share their work with the world. And then God bless the audiences. Because audiences or, you know, American citizens, folks who have less access to inspiration erode the democracy from the point of a lack of sight onto the creative horizon.
I wanted to also ask you, Bamuthi, about Trump's executive order Yes. signed last week appointing the vice president, J.D. Vance, to eliminate, quote, divisive race-centered ideology, unquote, from Smithsonian Museums, research centers, and the National Zoo. The order called Restoring Truth and Sanity to American History aims to remove exhibits and programs that portray U.S. history and values as inherently harmful and oppressive, unquote. It cites, in particular, the National Museum of African American History and Culture, which opened in 2016. The Smithsonian operates independently since it was established as a public-private partnership by Congress in 1846, but roughly receives 60% of its funding from the federal government. You know, you're an Oakland guy, but you've moved to Washington for yeah. your job that you were just fired from, and I'm sure you've spent time at the African American Museum. The significance of putting Absolutely. Vance in charge of deciding what exhibits are appropriate or not, what is American or not.
Yeah. Yeah. It is chilling. It is a harbinger. It is a signifier in the most ominous of terms. I think about the words of John F. Kennedy. Inscribed on the wall at the Kennedy Center. Kennedy spoke of an America that was unafraid of grace and beauty. I think about the writers and the teachers who made me. Everyone from Dr. Daniel Omotosho Black at Clark Atlanta University to the author Toni Morrison, the poet Nikki Giovanni. I think about how they all authored the story of our overcoming. America is actually built on struggle. And, you know, it's obviously impossible to decouple American history from a genocidal, hyper-patriarchal, hyper-capitalist frame and origin story. But the idea of democracy itself is a radical idea. The Constitution itself is a critical theory. It describes a way, a populist way that requires participation in order to actually make the country thrive. In order to be, in order to fully participate in the democracy, you
you have to sublimate or suppress your apathy. My partners at Sozo Artists and I think about the idea that the way to turn apathy into empathy is to infuse inspiration as a conversion element. These museums, these Smithsonian museums, inspire folks because they distill the story of our overcoming. You enter, even if you entered one of the Smithsonian institutions apathetic as to the idea of struggle or overcoming, you are inspired inside of that institution, and you leave a more compassionate and more empathetic human being. So, you know, this description of what the Smithsonian institutions do, particularly, you know, what we call the Blacksonian here locally, you know, that description is severely un-American and disconnected from the American promise. But maybe more critically, it minimizes the opportunity to generate empathy among not only the citizens of this country, but visitors from all over the world. Mm.
Mark Bamuthi Joseph, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Renowned artist and playwright, fired from his role as vice president and artistic director of the Kennedy Center's Social Impact Initiative. When we come back, we remember Free Press co-founder Robert McChesney, tireless defender of media and democracy. Back in 20 seconds. Barawanwa, Waiting for the Arrival of a Son by Aurelio Martinez, featuring Yusu Endur. Aurelio was killed last week at the age of 55 in a plane crash. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. We end today's show with the words of Robert McChesney, co-founder of the advocacy group Free Press, tireless defender of media and democracy. He's died at the age of 72. Bob McChesney was a prolific author of nearly three dozen books on media, democracy, and digital rights, including Rich Media, Poor Democracy, a beloved professor at University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. He appeared on Democracy Now! Multiple times over the years. In a minute, we'll hear Bob in his own words. But first, John, introduce him to people who did not know Bob McChesney as we remember him.
Bob McChesney was one of the great public intellectuals of our era, a scholar who was respected and awarded by Harvard and every other university for his writings and for his thinking, who lectured all over the United States and all over the world. He could have easily lived in the ivory tower. Instead, he chose to become an activist, to take the ideas that he had developed about the danger of media monopoly, about the importance of protecting a diverse and open and free press, about the need for net neutrality, into the public debate. And I think to a greater extent than anyone in the contemporary era, it was Bob McChesney who really introduced people to the idea that media itself could be an issue, that we could debate about whether our media system serves democracy or whether it serves corporate power. He argued that too frequently it serves corporate power, and that there is a desperate need for a small d democratic media in the United States. He loved Democracy Now! Because of what it does in that regard, but he also loved independent grassroots media across this country and the people who advocate for it.
So John Nichols wrote the book with Bob McChesney, The Death and Life of American Journalism. We're going to go back in time to 2006 to 2013, when Juan Gonzalez and I spoke with Robert McChesney at the Democracy Now! Table.
Well, I think when the internet began, and this is like, seems like ancient history now, in the 80s and 90s, when first people became aware of it, it was seen largely as a non-commercial oasis. It was a place where people could go and be equal and be empowered as citizens to take on concentrated economic and political power, to battle propaganda, and there was no advertising, there was no commercialism, that was off limits, and there was no surveillance. People could do what they wanted and not be tracked. And that was the great democratic vision that started the internet, that Aaron Swartz believed in. And I think what we've seen in the last 20 years is that's been turned on its head. And I think most people are oblivious to what's taking place because the thinking is, well, I can still do my thing. I can go to the Democracy Now! Website. I can find other cool websites and hang out there. And as long as I can do my own thing, I can text my friends and have a Facebook page, life is good. But it doesn't really work that way. What's been taking place, and I think it's really crystallized in the last 5 years, is that on a number of different fronts, extraordinarily large monopolistic corporations have emerged. AT&T, Verizon, Comcast, at the access level, Google, Facebook, Apple, Amazon, at the application and use level. And these firms have changed the nature of the internet dramatically. And they've done it by becoming huge monopolies with immense power. And they're, what they're able to do is collect information on us that's absolutely unbelievable. We have no privacy anymore. And use that information itself to advertisers. And then I think most strikingly what I get at in the book is that they work closely with the government and the national security state and the military. They're really walk hand in hand collecting this information, monitoring people in ways that by all democratic theory are inimical to a free society.
Well, Bob, one of the things that you raise in your book that critics of the media, both from the left and the right, have had a blind spot for years of not doing enough of a political economic analysis of the developments of the various forms of media and especially of the internet. And what are some of the main things that you raise in terms of the political economy of the media in your book?
Well, you have to look at the, first of all, access to the internet. And the access to the internet people get in this country is controlled by a cartel, basically, of AT&T, Verizon with cell phones and Comcast through cable line. And what we have in this country as a result of that is Americans pay far more for cell phones, they pay far more for broadband wired access than any other comparable country in the world, and we get much worse service. And it has nothing to do with the technology, it has nothing to do with quote-unquote economics, it has everything to do with corrupt policy making and the power of these firms. And that gives them the power to basically try to privatize the internet as much as possible, make it their own because they know people have no alternative. If you want a cell phone, you don't have 14 choices. You've basically got one or two, and when they get that big, when you dominate a market as much as an AT&T or Verizon, you're not really competing like 75 hot dog vendors compete. You have see much more in common than you do in competition, and so that's why it's considered now a cartel. But that's just the beginning. Once you get through that bottleneck onto the internet, what we've seen is that the internet was promised to be this great engine of economic competition. It was going to spur economic growth, create all these new businesses, huge amounts of jobs. Remember the term new economy from the late 90s? And instead, what we've seen is the internet is arguably the biggest generator of monopoly in history. I mean, at every place you look, from Google to Apple to Amazon to Facebook to Twitter, network economics lend themselves in such a way that you get one company that runs the table and no one else really can get a peep in. And these monopolies then generate massive profits, which they use as the basis to create empires. Google going out, Microsoft going out, taking their monopoly money and gobbling up all the other enterprises to build even larger digital empires. The way to understand these huge empires, Google, Facebook, Apple, Amazon, is they're all like continents of the world. Imagine it's the late 19th century. They've each got a continent, North America, South America, Asia, Africa. And their continent is their gusher monopoly basis, where they're the monopoly to get these huge profits. And then they use those profits to branch out and take a tax on the other continents to get a bigger chunk of it. Because they really know everyone's out to take over the world, but they're the only players in the game. If you don't have a continent, you're not a player. And what's happened on the internet, too, is that with the rise of patents, that these companies use to basically prevent newcomers from coming in addition to network economics, it's become much more closed off than it was 10 or 15 years ago. A lot of Google's been the first to admit, we could never start Google today. We'd have to go through so many lawsuits just to even get out of our office, it would be unthinkable.
What does net neutrality mean today?
Net neutrality, in the theory of it or the practice, or both?
Both.
Well, in theory, the idea of net neutrality is it's an acknowledgement that we have this cartel that controls access to the internet. And because we have this cartel, there's tremendous incentive for Comcast or AT&T and Verizon to want to basically privatize the internet. Say, we control what you can get on the internet and what doesn't, if you want to be on our network, and then they can shake people down for money. It also is immense political power, unimaginable political power. And, you know, this is something that the media reform movement, free press, we've all
organized on this for the last decade to prevent companies from using their monopoly power to be able to censor what gets through on the internet. So you have an open network. And now, if we actually had a public service like a post office system, it wouldn't be a debate you'd have, because there'd be no incentive to censor off dissident voices. Everyone would have access, no questions asked. It's a huge fight, and it's a difficult fight because there's so much money on the other side.
What is the fate of the content providers in this world where basically the people who control the pipes and the search engines and the aggregators have the main economic power? What happens to the journalists, the musicians, the artists, and those who produce the actual content that people want to access over these systems?
Sheer unmitigated disaster. And then we all know this. Newsrooms now look like plagues. And, the internet's not solely responsible for the collapse of journalism. I think that media consolidation has led to a shrinking of newsrooms relatively over the last 25 years. It's not a new thing. But what the internet has done is it greatly accelerated it and made it permanent. Right now, we're faced with the dark situation that there's really no way to make commercial interests can make money doing journalism.